This is research that has any bearing on what you guys are experiencing or not, but it has created quite a stir in the United States. About a year ago, the Pew Charitable Trust, which does a lot of demographic research in the U.S. on a variety of themes, found that the fastest growing religious group in the United States are the nuns, N-O-N-E-S, the people who check none when asked what their religious affiliation is. Okay? And so this has been cause for a huge stir. And so, as you probably know, most of these nuns tend to be, well, not most of them, but the fastest growing part of the fastest growing group are young adults between 18 and 26. You probably know Charlize Theron played, it wasn't a very positive spin on what young adulthood was, the movie Young Adult. But anyway, the nuns, let me just describe what the research found. It's nearly double the number of people as reported this a decade ago, which is a really fast clip in sociological speak. So about 50, it was 8% 10 years ago, now it's 15%. One out of four 18 to 26-year-olds fall into this category. It's a significant enough shift that Time magazine called this phenomenon one of the, in this, a couple issues ago, one of the 10 ideas that are changing our lives right now. It's a very shocking realization for a lot of people that this is possible, that you would consider yourself a nun before you would check having a religious affiliation. It's not just regional. This is true in every state in the United States. It's not, you might have expected this in the urban centers before. It's true everywhere. This is the young adult, another scene from the young adult movie. And a lot of this, I think, has to do with the kind of things that Charles Taylor was talking about that we just mentioned. There are more people who are nuns, self-identified as nuns in the U.S. than mainline Protestants or evangelical Christians. And the majority of nuns were raised in religious homes, and two-thirds of those were in Christian homes. Okay. Now, this is also interesting. Most of them are not atheist or agnostic. They're just, they're just nuns. Yeah, I don't, it's kind of whatever, you know. I'm a little bit of this and a little bit of that, you know. They're not going searching. They're not seekers. This is a problem with Christian Smith's research in the way he defines, he says there's not a lot of religious seeking going on, but the way he defines that is a seeker is somebody who goes out and looks for something from Buddhism and looks for something from Hinduism and looks for something from Islam and looks for something from Christianity. They don't look, but if they run across something they like, yeah, they borrow it, you know. And if there's a Catholic practice here and a Protestant Catholic, fine, you know. So they're not hostile about it. We'll come back to this in a minute. They are most likely to be poor white males under 30. This is a big change, actually, and I'll come back to that. It also has to do with the educational level. It used to be, in the United States, the more educated you were, the less likely you were to be religious. Now that is reversed. I'll come back to that. It's not because of the educated people are more faithful, in case you thought. They do have some religious-ish habits, okay? For one thing, they still gather in sacred spaces. But space is different. But they're gathering to have conversations about things that are meaningful, right? And the Starbucks or the you've heard of the third place, you know, the place that's not home and not work, but it's a sacred space for you, right? They tend to be prophetic, and they have kind of a sense that the world is flat. Did the Occupy thing make it to South Africa? And, of course, nobody ever knew what these people were for, but they knew what they were against, right? And they tend to view themselves as a prophetic voice in the culture. They have religious-ish rituals. Anybody know what Burning Man is? Mm-hmm. Burning Man is, what is it? It's like an arts, Woodstocky kind of festival that's held in the desert. I don't even know, somewhere out west in the U.S. Yeah. Africa Burning, okay, okay. And the idea is you bring a group of people in a creative project of some sort that you enact there, and these are just pictures I pulled off the web of different kinds of crazy things people have created in the middle of the desert. Sometimes it's performance art. Burning Man, he's not really being burned in effigy, even though that's what it looks like. It's just a symbol of the event. You have people living in cupcakes. I don't know, you know, you've got people making crazy bicycles. Sometimes it's performance art. Sometimes it's architecture. You know, it's crazy. And the whole thing is you leave the desert as you found it. So it's temporary. It all goes away within, I don't know how long yours is. This may be a week or two. I don't know. I have students who have taught me this because they're doing dissertations that are looking at it. Really, they just all want an excuse to go. But the point is, actually, one of them is doing her dissertation on the arts as a holy encounter for young Presbyterians. And so these are students who, or they're not all students, these are young people who have a sense that there's something sacred. But they're not finding that expressed in the language of the church. They're finding it expressed in the language. You know, just as a point of comparison, just a couple of sidebars. First of all, in the African American church, which grew directly out of slavery, you know, so it's a different history, obviously. But they, you know, the African American church was born as a form of solidarity to survive this horrible condition of slavery in North America. Theology, first of all, is operationalized more than it is explicit, you know. So to be what counts as a Christian has a lot more to do with what, you know, how you live it out than what you say you are. That would be number one. The other thing that is really interesting in this conversation is just the observation that, you know, Christianity actually is a religion of the poor. Well, most of us forgot that somewhere along the line. Most of our churches have forgotten that. We wouldn't be here if we didn't have resources that, you know, poor churches and poor people don't have. And yet the gospel itself originated out of, you know, the context of the poor and actually, you know, was first embraced by poor people because it's a gospel of hope. And there's something about this conversation that makes me want to recall that, you know, kind of reclaim that somehow. Well, let me just suggest, first of all, that I think the habits of the nuns are actually not alien to us. You know, I think there are days that we feel like some of those expressions and rituals and so on might be an authentic representation of kind of our own spirituality in some ways, too. I don't know whether we'd go to Africa Burning, is that what it's called? It's really interesting. And, you know, but we have our own ways of, you know, just kind of longing for something that's a little bit closer to the ground, a little bit more authentic, a little bit that feels like it's got more Velcro on it, the sticky faith stuff. And so I think we probably have, even as pastors, we probably have more in common with this group than we acknowledge sometimes. I was at a conference recently of young pastors, and we had breakout groups of about 12 people in each group. And these were pastors from all denominations. Some were emerging church, non-denominational. Some were Presbyterian and Methodist, and I don't think we had any Catholics. But in one of the breakout sessions, one of the pastors asked her peers, here was the question, would you go to the church that you serve if you weren't being paid? A really good question. You know how many people said yes in a group of 12?
Two.
Two. That's exactly right. Two. And there's this old joke that they tell about the this guy who didn't want to get out of bed to go to church, and he was whining about going to church, and you know, his mom says, you have to go to church. And he's like, I don't want to go to church. His mom said, you have to go to church. Like, I don't want to go to church. Give me one good reason why I have to go to church. And his mom said, because you're the pastor, right? So we're kind of in that situation. You know, we got a situation now where even the pastors don't want to go to church. And so I think there is some recognition of this sense that there's something holy that is being claimed in some ways in the secular culture, that churches have no longer been able to, you know, communicate with a lot of fidelity. So is the answer to being having a stronger missional imagination as a congregation or as a church to become a younger church? That's a question that a lot of people in the U.S. at least are throwing out there, and there are a number of initiatives usually thrown down from the hierarchy of the denomination saying, you need more young people, we need to be a younger church, right? I'm going to suggest that that might be the wrong way to go about this. Because here's the point I want to make with this session. The key to being a younger church is not age, it's hope. And we're going to use Moltmann to make that point. But theologically, what makes us youth, theologically, isn't our chronological age, but it's the sense that death is not confining us. The possibility of death is not on the horizon in a near and present way. And of course, what that means is you can have young people who are old souls, and you can have old souls who are young people, right, if you use that definition. So we'll come back to that. There are a couple temptations I'm going to suggest that we want to avoid, okay? Not those temptations. One is a demographic temptation, and that is thinking that young people will save the church. And the other is a theological temptation, and that is thinking that a younger church is the same thing as having a lot of young people in the pews. All right, so let's go back to these. Temptation number one, youth will save the church. And by the way, this has happened through history. There's lots and lots of data out there that shows that throughout history, that you see a lot of language in all sorts of church archives about how young people will save the church they because of X, Y, or Z. There are different reasons for it. Let's just get the theological point out of the way first. No, Jesus saves the church, not young people save the church. But what is really going on here is that we tend to think of youth ministry as a defensive strategy. And it is designed in a lot of places to save an ailing church, okay? But in doing so, when we approach youth ministry that way, what we are doing is using young people for our own institutional ends, right? I call that vampire theology. And what happens is we look at young people when they come through the door, especially young adults. We don't look at them as people of God, but we look at them as young blood that the church needs to survive. And then we proceed to suck the life right out of them, you know, for our own survival. That's vampire theology. Now, churches are not the only social institution doing that. Almost every organization that's been founded in the past century is predicated on a principle that makes absolutely no sense to the nuns or most other people who are under the age of 30. And that principle is membership. You know, membership doesn't make a lot of sense for a lot of cultural reasons. It's just not a category that young people think about. Today, young people find membership pretty much to be a meaningless term, because young people don't join anything. It's not just church. They don't join. Have you noticed, if you've done youth ministry for a long time, you know, I think you could probably go back to when I started in youth ministry 25 years ago, you know, certainly when I was a teenager, and young people would join, you could use that language, you would join a club, you would join the youth group, you might even join the church, you know. Young people don't join. That's part of a cultural dynamic, but it has some big implications for us. Now, I'm going to come back to this. It doesn't mean that institutions are meaningless, but they mean something in a different way. A doctoral dissertation that I advise that finished this year is by a guy named Drew Dyson, and he studied churches that have a very good track record with young adults, with people who are likely to be nuns. Okay. And he found that churches that do a good job with this demographic are strong on three variables, okay? Meaning, you know, they will deal with, they are interested in helping, you know, foster conversations about what matters in life. Belonging, There is a sense, it's not important that you come to church as a predictor. This is true for teenagers too. The predictor is not whether you come to church as a teenager. The predictor is if you want to have a long-term relationship with the church. What predicts whether you're going to have a long-term relationship with the church is that when you come, you sense that you belong. You see? So attendance by itself is too simple. Belonging is what matters. And the last thing is radical hospitality. By radical, it means an unjudgmental hospitality. So what that means is, and you know, if I were a pastor today, I would definitely change this assumption. Because when I was a pastor, it's been almost 20 years, I'm actually going back into that role this year, but the last time I pastored a church before this year was about 20 years ago. And I had the assumption that most people in my congregation were there because they were either Christians or they wanted to be. That was a wrong assumption then, and it's really a wrong assumption now. There are lots and lots of complex reasons why people come to church. Funny thing, you want to know what most pastors think is the reason people come to church? Close. What do you think? Preaching. No. You know what lay people say that's the reason they come to church? The people, the community. Belonging. Yeah. Well, because this has to do with the, hang on a second. He says, thank you for asking that. He says if you put these things together, they add up to a missional ecclesiology, a form of doing church in which we are sent out on behalf of Christ into the world. And they're fairly explicit about that. But that's a good question. If you just look at those three things by themselves, without the broader framework, they could belong to any club, right? Yeah, right. In fact, let's see if this works. Meaning, belonging, radical hospitality. Not sure about radical hospitality, but, you know, I wonder if you could get Hitler Youth into that. You know, I mean, so you're right. It has to have this kind of framework on it. Okay, good point. Yeah, please. Hamburger thing, these Muslim kids may or may not convert to Christianity at some point, but I'll bet they never pass a church without remembering the ministry that they are experiencing there in Christ's name. I would wager Christ would treat them the same way, you know, that Christ would welcome them with that kind of openness without apologizing for who he is, right? But also without, you know, co-opting them, because then it's not love, right? Then it's power control. Yeah. So.
I mean, I'm checking for what you say, but that's also the three reasons why a lot of Christians are turning to Islam.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. Well, and I mean, you can. There are lots of. There's studies that have been done about the parallels between gang culture and what we say we want in churches, right? You know, you meaning, belonging, radical hospitality. Again, the radical hospitality, let me define the radical hospitality the way what he found in these churches. They understood themselves as being countercultural in the way of Jesus by being radically hospitable to people other churches excluded. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So it was kind of a counterintuitive way to think about it. This is his particular sample anyway. you know, but that's a really good observation.
But that is the distinguishing mark, isn't it? Isn't that radical hospitality what distinguishes us from what we described before?
I think you could make you could say that, but that actually isn't what I would say distinguishes us. Did I say extinguishes us or distinguishes us? Here's what I think it means. I think radical hospitality, to the extent that it extends, it exacts a cost. I think the mark of Christianity is the suffering love of Christ. You know, the sacrificial love. And this is where moralistic therapeutic deism draws the line. You know, I will love you as long as it doesn't cost me anything. Right? Because I'm first and foremost about preserving myself here. But if it costs me, then it really is radical. It's not just being nice to the nth degree. It's a kind of hospitality that means I'm willing to, you know, put myself out for the sake of this other person I don't even know. You know. So that's what, I mean, I think if you're going to look at it that way, then it could be a distinctive mark. Yeah, please.
Yeah, I think he is correct in that radical hospitality. Because that is how you will attract the different religions or the different cultures. The problem, the dynamic of that is how do you translate and transform or you know, shift that radical hospitality over.
Yeah.
You know, into the group to continue that radical hospitality. But like you said, you get to a point where you burn out with the radical hospitality because you are the you know, you are the one that's creating it.
Yeah.
But the suggestion is to transfer that over for the continuum here.
Right.
And because that is what happens, like correctly said, what you have in Buddhism and you have different religions that captured in this because there's something different to it.
Yeah.
There's something different to this culture that we are in now that we are affected, all walks, all groups. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that's just where we get stuck, like the escalator.
Yeah.
They are there, but how do we move on from there? You know?
Well, and I think what I think you're making a really good point. Part of it is to remember, our hospitality burns out. We are not an endless supply. Yeah, we are our cup gets emptied. So we have to take on the hospitality of Christ, right? Now, our hospitality just won't do it. And kids will be betrayed by us. We don't want to betray them, but we don't have it in us not to, because we run out of steam. Okay, so only God's love is sufficient for that, right? And to be turning them towards not here, there, not me, him. Don't come to me, go to him. I, but not I, said Paul, right? And so part of it is constantly shifting the direction. Now, kids are reluctant to make that move, but there will be a day when you fail them, right? Now, having said that, they also know what the difference is between someone who loves them in the sense of, you know, a casual kind of friendship and someone who loves them to the point that they would, you know, throw themselves in front of a bus for you, you know. And when they experience that kind of love, that is taking on the love of Christ, right? I would die for you, you know. And die means all sorts of things. Hopefully we don't physically die, but you know, you've worked with kids that you have died to self for, you know, 100 times, and you've wondered, has anybody ever noticed? And I'm here to say, yeah, they noticed. Whether they can say it or not, they noticed. And they have precious few places where they can get that. And if they don't get it in the church, they will not get it anywhere else. So that is the signature, I think, you know. Anyway, language of the arts. Yeah. Okay, so now you get to go back to... In terms of it not being our church, let me throw a couple of other things into the conversation here, just because I want to make sure that we're clear about the way young people do work with institutions. We said earlier that, you know, they don't think membership is important, but actually they do think, and despite what we say, they do think institutions are important, but here's how. It's not the way we often think. It doesn't occur to young people that they are going to find meaning, belonging, and radical hospitality in churches. It just doesn't dawn on a lot of them that that's where they might go to find it. And so we often interpret this lack of interest in joining up as being a lack of interest in us or in the institution. And we don't want to scare them, so we don't ask anything of them, which might be the wrong way to go. You were talking about the participation and leadership through these political rallies, you know, to have young people participating in the actual leadership of the congregation is really huge, too. But what happens is that the research is telling us, at least in the United States, is that young people are not abandoning institutions as much as institutions are abandoning young people. And what that is true on a lot of fronts, and this is especially true in the 18 to 26-year-old bracket, because you think about it, you know, school, you're done with school, you graduate from school. You know, most kids, even though a lot of them move back home, they are in a very different relationship with their family of origin. You know, they are either semi-independent or maybe they are actually independent of them. They tend not to be involved in mediating institutions like churches or even, you know, social clubs, bowling out. You might have read Putman's Bowling Alone. They don't join bowling leagues or any of that stuff anymore. The exception is the institution of the media, which accompanies young people all the way through. But they are the only institution accompanying young people all the way through. Most institutions back off once a kid graduates from high school. And so what happens is that leaves people in this crucial period of 18 to 26 when arguably some of the most decisive, long-lasting, irrevocable decisions of your life get made, you know, you're making them alone. Well, you're making them actually without the guidance of institutions. And why institutions aren't magic, but you're making them without what institutions have to offer, which are traditions and elders. Okay? And without those two things, who are you left with to help guide you? Right? Well, you're left with your peers, the group. And you probably have experienced this. For young people, the group, it's not a formal membership. It's just a collection of people who come together to help raise each other, basically, and during this period of interstitial space, and they become the sacred community of young people. You can see it on TV shows. You probably you have these shows, Friends, right? And then you've got Vampire Diaries, and then you've got Gossip Girls. You know, any show that is marketed to this demographic is going to have the sacred group as part of it. And so there are a couple of things that we can take from that. One is we have a peer segregated society, right? And young people live within the group, they play within the group, they kind of do their soul searching within the group, they survive within the group. And if you don't have a group like this, you are largely lost, right? Those of us in churches, we often want to give young people some space so they can experiment and do this sort of things, because we think, after all, when they have children, they will come back. This is a myth we have to get over. Child rearing is not the reason people come back to church. The research says that the reason people are most likely to come back to church, at least in the U.S., is when you get married. Okay? Well, you might say, okay, well, that's fine. Except that, right now, I don't know if you've read the statistics on marriage, there are fewer marriages in the U.S. than at any other time in this century. And like 40% of children are born out of wedlock right now. I mean, it's massive. And what's more, as the age of marriage gets put off, but we know that young people get less religious, not more religious, as they get older. So these are things that are working against the idea of them coming back to church, right? So after graduation, they either stay the same religiously or they become less religious. The exception is if, this is interesting, if you start out as a highly devoted teen and your parents were religiously active while you were in high school. Okay? So it turns out that while you're in high school, what your parents are doing religiously has a strong predictive effect on where your faith will be in the next 10 years. And it makes sense if you think about it, because what's happening is you're getting to see a model of adult faith. So that faith doesn't become just an extracurricular activity you do while you're in high school, because you have adults in your life who are faithful. And you're like, oh, so what it means to be an adult is to do faith like this. And faith is part of the equation of being an adult. If you don't have that, faith becomes like violin lessons. It's something you do, you know, because it makes you well-rounded, but then you quit when you, you know, go to college or leave home. The other exception is if young people have a profound religious experience of God. This is really interesting because the sociologist can't probe this one.
Mm-hmm.
And Christian Smith, to his credit, mentions it. And he kind of drops it in here and there because it's in the data, but he can't go there. You know, and this is something I think that bears more, now we can't really control for this, right? I beg God, please, profoundly show up to my son or daughter. Any day now would be great. God so far has not obliged on that front. But the bottom line is, if you have this profound holy experience as that you associate with God, and God coming to you, it's not that you go to God, it's God comes to you, it tends to trump every other variable out there, which is kind of interesting. Okay, so the return to church tends to be associated with marriage, not child rearing, but that, because that keeps getting put off later and later. The average age of marriage in the U.S. is 28. I don't know what it is here. In Europe, it's older. But anyway, it makes coming back to church less likely, even though they still long to belong, so they wind up with the group. Okay, second temptation. Young church requires having lots of youth in the pews. This is a good thing, okay? But as we said, youth will not save the church. Only Christ saves the church. And here's a marketing tip. Young people are tired of vampire theology. They do not want to be used to save our ecclesial rears, okay? They want to be, you know, treated like anybody else in the church, as somebody who has something to offer on their own right, and not, they see right through it if we are using them to try to survive through them. The theological temptation here is probably more important. Granted, there's a likely combination that maybe a young church is going to have a lot of young people, but it's not a necessary combination because the key variable here is hope. This is something, it's possible that we will have more young people in the pews, but not necessary. Here's a book that's coming out in the next month or so that I'm really nervous about. And I was asked to review this in Christianity Today, and I was so, I really... This was God's grace, I think, saving me from myself. I had agreed to do it, but then I had a funeral I had to go to unexpectedly the weekend I was going to write it, so I backed out. And now I have read the rest of the book, and I'm really glad that I'm not having to review this because I would not have said very positive things about it. But Christianity Today is convinced that this book is going to set the conversation for Christianity for a long time to come. And Tom Bergler has basically come out with a thesis that says that all these things that we associate with youth culture that have now come to define, you know, Christianity at large has made the whole church adolescent. And he has anything that's bad, he associates with being adolescent. Anything that's good, he associates with being adult. And it's very much, if you follow the feminization of the church arguments, anything bad has to do with, is considered a feminine trait. Anything good is considered a masculine trait in those studies. And so it has its parallels there. But it's a way probably we don't want to associate youth with juvenilization. That's the point of all that. So what Jürgen Moltmann says is that what makes us young is not age. It's the youth has the wide open sense of possibility that is promised when death is not on the horizon limiting us. So it's the confidence that death is not on the horizon, that the future is unbounded. The problem is we've got a church that has an anxiety disorder. And you have an anxiety disorder when you think your survival is at stake. So we have a church that doesn't believe death is not on the horizon. Churches think they're dying, right? They use the language. Uh-huh. And so if you know Murray Bowen's thesis on anxiety disorders, anxiety or the sense that your survival is being threatened causes one of four reactions. Either you fight, you freeze, you flee, or you protect. Okay? So one thing, this happens with individuals, but it happens with churches too. If churches feel like their survival is at stake, they're probably stuck in one of these reactions. All right? Think about your church for a second. We're not going to go back to your partner for a second, but just think about where in your congregation you might see signs of an anxiety disorder of some sort. You know, does your church fight, freeze, protect, or flee? You know? And the reason for this is because, you know, when you're under stress, your brain responds differently. You, instead of responding with the judgment centers of the brain, we respond with the reptilian part of the brain that's back here. And the good thing about that is the reptilian part of the brain's really fast, you know, and so it gets us out of trouble fast. But the bad thing is it doesn't consider things very carefully. And as a result, people who are stressed out using this part of their brain, you can't think, you can't appreciate nuance, you lose your sense of humor, find that that paradox bothers you, you can't get any energy into looking after the outsider, you're too busy protecting your own. I mean, does this sound like anything you've seen in the church lately? Yeah, that's what I thought. Okay. Hope. Moltmann's words, it's not that the future belongs to the young, it's that the future makes us young. So by that standard, what that means is all Christian churches are young churches. Because Jesus removes the fear of death from the specter on the horizon. We are not defined by death being on the horizon. We have the wide open possibility that's promised by eschatology. And Moltmann tells the story of Pope John Paul II, who late in his life he was really in a lot of pain at this point, but he goes back in 2002 to his hometown in Poland. And he visits the youth. He started out as a youth minister. I don't know if you knew that about John Paul II. But he visits the youth of his town, and they all surround him, and they start chanting, "You are young, you are young." And he goes, no. But then this was the scripture. Youth shall faint and be weary, young men shall fall exhausted, but they who wait upon the Lord will renew their strength. And they shall mount up with wings like eagles, and they shall run and not be weary, they shall walk and not faint. So I thought I would just close our time together here before we break into groups again with a statement of hope, again, from a secular young person, a guy named Jonathan Reed. Here's what happened. There was this film contest that was sponsored by the American Association for Retired Persons. And the film contest went like this. Imagine yourself at age 50, okay, and make a film about it. Okay, and so what he did was he wrote a palindrome poem, and a palindrome poem is one that reads the same backwards and forwards, okay, and then he put it online. He came in second place, by the way, but his thing went viral, so he probably won. Okay, and this is how we close.
I am part of a lost generation.
And I refuse to believe that I can change the world.
I realize this may be a shock, but happiness comes from within is a lie.
And money will make me happy.
So I'm very weird. I don't have any children, but they are not the most important thing in my life.
My employees know that I have my priorities.
Because work is more important than family. I tell you this. Once upon a time, family came together, but this will not be true in my era. This is a quick fix to life.
Experts tell me 30 years from now I will be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce.
I did not foresee that I will live in a country of my own making. In the future, environmental destruction will be the norm. No longer can it be said that my peers may care about others. It will be evident that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It is foolish to pursue what they are supposed
to. And all of this will come true unless we choose to reverse it.
There is hope. It is foolish to presume that my generation is apathetic and lethargic. It will be evident that my peers and I care about others. No longer can it be said that environmental destruction will be the norm. In the future, I will live in a country of my own making.
I do not conceive that 30 years from now I'll be celebrating the 10th anniversary of my divorce.
Experts tell me this is a quick fix society, but this will not be true in my era. Families stay together once upon a time. I tell you this, family is more important than work.
My employer will know that they are not the most important thing in life.
So in 30 years, I will tell my children, money will make me happy is a lie, and happiness comes from within. I realize this may be a shock, but I can change the world.
And I refuse to believe
person you've been talking to.